From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The NASDAQ is trying to regain ground today after absorbing Monday's news that Congress plans to investigate Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google to find out if these big tech behemoths are stifling competition or otherwise need to be broken up. Representative David Cicilline, the Democrat from Rhode Island and chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, announced the new investigation yesterday. And Ali Velshi's ears picked up. He's the MSNBC host and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello there, Robin.
So calls to break up big tech have been going on for a while. 2020 candidate Elizabeth Warren called for it in March. Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes wrote that op-ed calling for it in May. Why is Congress moving now?
Yeah, and Scott Galloway from NYU had written a book about this a year ago. Roger McNamee has spoken about it in his book, Zucked. The issue is that I think Congress has been behind the eight ball on this one. It, you know, this is one of those instances where technology moves much faster than regulation, and they've been watching the British Parliament and the European Union take more aggressive action against these companies. And, you know, they really saw in the books that I talked about and Elizabeth Warren's very detailed proposal, a possible roadmap to go down to say, look, we have a problem that goes against our history of antitrust work in that companies who control the platform are also controlling content and we need to take action. So it looks like the sensible argument has been made to Congress and they're prepared to take this up now.
Well, but is the law there? Because as we know, the standard for figuring out whether a company has a monopoly has always been market share. You know,
yeah.
Too much of it means no competition, usually higher prices. The consumer has nowhere to go.
Yep.
But companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon have services that are either free or, in Amazon's case, low cost. Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes, in that op-ed that he wrote about this, says there's more to it than prices. What, remind us.
Yeah, and there really is, because this is the sort of we've always thought about competition in terms of price to the end user. And the fact is now we're dealing with an entire space that was created by some of these companies that is dominated by them on every level and in every vertical. So, you know, Jerry Nadler has said that given the growing tide of the concentration and consolidation, they've got to investigate the current state of competition and maybe the health of the antitrust laws themselves. So this is not just a matter of looking at whether current laws can apply to these companies, because as you point out, in many cases, they cannot. Mm. The idea is, do we have to think of antitrust very differently in the world where the customer gets free data or free services at some other expense?
Right. I mean, you know, as Chris Hughes pointed out, there's a stifling of innovation because Facebook just buys up competitors.
Uh-huh.
There's no consumer choice. If you want a company that promises more privacy, there isn't one, you know. So those are new issues. Look, is there a whiff of politics here? Because we know Facebook was used by Russian trolls to sow division in the 2016 election. Facebook sold data to the Stephen Bannon-backed firm
Cambridge Analytica.
So some might say, well, this is just lawmakers wanting to blame someone, so they take it out on Mark Zuckerberg. Is it bipartisan?
I think it's getting to be bipartisan. What I think you see the division in Congress is that younger people who understand technology versus older people who don't understand it as well. That's sort of the problem. This is a much bigger problem than partisan stuff, and I think once folks look at it, they'll say the entire infrastructure of one of our most successful industries in this country needs to be looked at carefully. Yeah, there are partisan whiffs at the most basic level, but when you look across the pond to the UK example and the European example, what you realize is that good, smart law that can sort of help us for the next 50 or more years is probably the way we should be looking at that. But you have to fundamentally read a few of these books or read Elizabeth Warren's stuff or understand technology well enough to understand how to legislate this.
Right after you read the Mueller report. Look,
right after you read the Mueller report.
You know, all of this could take years, but I just want to ask, we see the markets reacting. Is that because tech stocks have been driving so much of the growth, or what is their concern?
Look, tech stocks have been driving a lot of the growth. The point is they're not losing customers on any front. So after all the attention that Facebook has had in the last couple of years, the bottom line is the stock has continued to do well. So even a little bit of a market adjustment doesn't really matter in this particular instance. These companies, everybody who argues for their breakup continues to argue that they can do phenomenally well even if they are contained a little bit. So I don't think as an investor or a potential investor, I don't think this is really something to worry about.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC economics anchor and correspondent. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, in Missouri, the question of whether the state's last abortion clinic can remain open is back in court today, the latest in the national battle over abortion rights. In Connecticut, legal matters involving embryos are being discussed in a different way. The state's Supreme Court heard arguments recently in a case concerning who should get possession of frozen human embryos after a divorce. Connecticut Public Radio's Nicole Leonard reports.
Advancements in medical technology have given people more fertility options. They can cryogenically freeze sperm, eggs, or human embryos to create or expand their families. But when relationships end and possession disputes happen, is the law keeping up? Catherine Kraschel specializes in reproductive health law at Yale.
A frozen embryo is a novel thing to be part of the components of a marriage and things that people have acquired or built together. And so courts have had to grapple with how to best handle that.
Some of the highest courts in the country are hearing arguments on how to classify a frozen embryo. They're also trying to figure out who should get one in a divorce. Recently, Supreme Court justices in Connecticut heard from attorneys each representing Timothy Goodwin and Jennifer Bilbao. They're divorced and in dispute over an embryo created while they were married.
If there's a disagreement, why can't the human embryo be given to the parent that wants to preserve its life and the decisions go forward from there?
That's Joseph Sekola arguing before the justices. He's the attorney representing the husband, Goodwin, who wants to preserve the embryo for adoption. Now, Goodwin did sign a contract with his then-wife years ago. It instructed that any remaining embryos were to be destroyed. But now he's changed his mind. Meanwhile, his ex-wife, Jennifer Bilbao, wants to stick to their original agreement. Here's her attorney, Scott Garrison, on why contracts should be upheld.
That would nip the vast majority of these future disputes in the bud so that we're not back here.
These contracts are used a lot at fertility treatment centers. They help couples decide on what would happen in future situations just like this. Kraschel, the Yale expert, says they also help protect fertility centers, but they don't always work as intended.
When patients are signing a form with their medical provider, most of the time they're not necessarily contemplating these very profound issues of family formation and identity when we're thinking about people who object to their genetic material being used to create a human, perhaps without their consent.
The validity of these contracts in embryo possession cases has varied. In New York and California, courts have chosen to enforce contract agreements. In Iowa and Massachusetts, couples ultimately have to come to a mutual agreement while an embryo remains frozen. And in Tennessee and Pennsylvania, courts have decided to use a balancing test, which weighs the interests of both parents. But Kraschel says there's another profound question at the heart of these cases.
Is the embryo property, or is it more like a child in which we think about a custody arrangement?
Defining where embryos fall on the scale of personhood, if they do at all, has been difficult, even for bioethicists like Dr. Louise King.
There is no way to say for sure when life truly begins. And we're not going to probably have a definitive way of stating that at any time soon.
King is a director of reproductive bioethics at Harvard Medical School and a practicing surgeon who used to be a lawyer. She says scientists have used bioethics to determine when to draw the line in experimentation, especially involving embryonic stem cells. But even that's a gray area. So for frozen embryos, or really pre-embryos, given that they only grow for about 4 to 5 days until frozen, King says it's actually more of a philosophical debate, not a scientific one.
If you believe that life begins at conception, then you will see an embryo of any stage as being a fully human being. But then, of course, if that's true, then you've afforded moral status to an entity that doesn't have any other criteria except for being genetically related to other human beings.
Some experts say these kinds of cases are attempts to chip away at, if not reverse, the Roe v. Wade decision, which protects abortion rights. Efforts to get a frozen embryo possession case before the U.S. Supreme Court have so far failed. The court declined to hear a Colorado embryo case in April, but fetal heartbeat and fetal personhood laws in other states challenged the landmark decision as well. And King says, even though science and bioethics don't support giving frozen human embryos a status deserving of full human rights,
this is clearly an entity that deserves our consideration and protection above, for example, a skin cell, right? It's not just a cell, but it's not also an infant, and it's not also potentially even a fetus right before it's born. And so it's something different.
But until there's more of a consensus on how to treat frozen embryos, states will have to navigate the complexity of these cases on their own. For Here and Now, I'm Nicole Leonard in Hartford.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on EmberWave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, control your comfort.
Our next guest is best known as the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, but 35-year-old Trevor Noah is also an author who recently adapted his 2016 book Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood for Young Readers. It's about his upbringing during and just after apartheid with a black mother and a white father. Trevor Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And I have to say, I was a little nervous as I was reading this and enjoying it in the version for young readers. I thought maybe my aptitude is not as... as it should be. Is there a difference between the original version and this one?
Well, here's the thing. I've changed some of the language and, you know, I've simplified some of the stories, but I didn't try to talk down to younger readers because I didn't like being talked down to when I was young.
I was just talking to a high school teacher in this country about what his students know about 9/11. And he said they know there was a plane, not four. They know the World Trade Center. They know Al-Qaeda, but nothing else until he teaches it to them. Why do you think American kids should know about apartheid and what you talk about in this book?
Well, you know, one thing I enjoyed when I was growing up in South Africa was in our schools, we learned about world history. You know, so we learned about American history. We learned about, you know, the French history. We learned about what happened in Russia. We learned about Europe. We learned about Africa. We learned about South Africa. And so for me, I think learning about history gives you some context. It gives you an idea of what the world was like. It also gives you an idea of where the world has gone to in comparison to the past. And so for me, you know, if you read stories from South Africa, if you read about apartheid, you come to realize that racism or oppression aren't unique ideas to America, first of all. And you also, I think, start to realize that it's an all too common idea, you know, or a common theme that happens all around the world.
Well, and what has your own experience made you realize about the racism in this country? I mean, just in the last few years, we've had Charlottesville, Virginia. We've had the shooting at the black church in Charleston. Even the president calling a black member of Congress low IQ. What do you think about the level of racism in America today?
Well, I think it's unfortunately, you know, part of the fabric of the country. You know, South Africa and America have very similar histories in that fundamentally the beginnings of the countries as we know them came from a place and a time when people had certain views about people of a different skin color. And so that has traveled through time, and that has translated into laws and policies that have affected, you know, black people in America, black people in South Africa. So for me, what's always interesting is seeing what similarities there are, but then also noticing what differences there are. You know, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that in many ways quelled any ideas that this never happened or it wasn't as bad as it was laid out to be. And I think that does something for a nation. It puts you in a place where you can't be gaslighted anymore. Whereas in America, it does feel like there's still a conversation about, is there racism, as opposed to how do you begin moving forward as a nation to get rid of the racism that has in many ways defined how people react with one another across racial barriers in the U.S.
Do you think it's gotten worse or better in this country since you've been in the U.S.?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. You know, I think some people will think it's gotten worse, and I'm careful to jump to that assumption. I think we've gotten more access to information. And so, you know, sometimes the curves of facts versus information can go against each other. I definitely think America has gotten better over time. You know, for anybody to say that 2019's racism is as bad as 1960s racism, right. I think is being a little disingenuous. I do think, however, social media, you know, camera phones, et cetera, have given us so much more access to these stories. Now, you know, you can watch a video of someone being berated by their boss and their boss is using the N-word in the office.
Or being shot by a police officer, too.
Yeah, you'd see an unarmed person being shot by a police officer. You would never see that before. It was a story where, you know, the police could present the facts however they wished, and that would probably be the end of the conversation. So I think we live in a world where now we're getting information on a different scale, and processing that information can often mean that even though the world may have gotten better gradually over time, we're now inundated with information that tells us otherwise.
You talk about how when you were a child, because you were half white and half black, you had a difficult time deciding which group you belonged in. You even moved into different school classes to be with black students because you felt more comfortable there than with the white students. Do you have more clarity now about who you are?
Well, I think as human beings, we're always trying to find out who we are. Sometimes the simplest distinctions to make are those that run along color lines. For myself, it was interesting being in a country where the law defined me as one race. I grew up in a different race, and for so long, people wanted to define me as whatever they wanted to define me as. And mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that clarity for me came from understanding my existence and then looking at the world around me. And I didn't do it in a negative way. It wasn't in protest or anything. It was just me understanding where I belonged and who I was, you know, because in South Africa, many people were faced with a choice. They could choose to aspire to a racial group that we were told was better than maybe the one we were. And so I think it was liberating for myself to realize that although the government had tried to define me as one race, you know, I comfortably identified with and was a black person. And that doesn't seem, you know, it seems like an obvious thing maybe, but when you grew up in South Africa, you realize how complicated it could actually be.
Can you believe that given your upbringing and all the things that you went through that you are now where you are now?
Oh, no, I don't take that for granted ever. But I like to think that I am the product of a world of impossibilities. You know, my mother is where she should have never been. You know, I think my mother made greater leaps than I have ever made. It's just that her leaps were made within her world and so maybe don't seem as grand. But I think, you know, my family, myself, my country, I come from a place where we have achieved the impossible. You know, a bloodless revolution, mm-hmm. a shifting of power from a minority to a majority without there being a mass bloodletting, I think is a really impossible story to tell, one that hasn't really been replicated anywhere else. So, yeah, I think I've come from a world where anything is possible. And so for myself, I never ever thought I'd be here because I didn't even know what here is. But I was lucky enough to grow up in a space where I was always told about what was possible. So, you know, there's a beautiful quote that I read the other day, which was, would you rather know what is real or would you rather know what is possible? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the latter informed how I lived my life.
As you know, there are a lot of people who actually get their news from the show that you do now, The Daily Show, as they do from a lot of more comedic shows that take on issues in the news. What do you think of what do you think of your responsibility in that sense right now to inform people?
Well, I think I have a responsibility to my audience as much as I have a responsibility to myself. And that's really how I try and create The Daily Show, is I try and be as informed as possible as a human being. And then the show would hopefully be a manifestation of that information.
Well, and do you think the media right now are doing a good job in covering the news today?
Well, I think the media is too broad a term. You know, I think the curse of America is that entertainment and news have bled into each other in such an extreme way that you really can't tar the media with any one brush.
Trevor Noah, this has been an entirely too serious conversation between Trevor Noah and anybody. So just in case of that, I saved this one clip that I do want to play because you're currently touring. You're doing stand-up, and there's a part from your Netflix special that I just have to play for our audience. Here it is.
Every trap song to me sounds like a toddler complaining about life. That's all I hear when I listen to trap songs. Every time a trap song plays on the radio, I think of my little brother. He'll go outside, he'll like hurt himself, he'll come back crying, and it sounds like every single trap song ever. He'll like walk in like, and I'll be like, yo, Isaac, what happened, buddy? He'll be like,
so I'm just going to bring it right back around as we listen to that, which I love. But I'll bring it right back around to sort of where you start in this book. And you're talking about how you speak all these different languages in South Africa. In your stand-up, how much does language fit into how you view the world and even what you find funny, in that case of trap as a toddler?
Language is completely the prism through which I see my entire life. You know, for me, language is both what separates and brings people together. Language is how we process emotion with other human beings. Language is how we hear and experience emotions and ideas around us in society. And I don't just mean English and French and German. I mean even the language that we use within language. You know, whether it's body language or, you know, whether it's music, or there are so many different languages that we have and possess as human beings that help us connect or help us define ourselves in this reality. And so for me, that's literally everything that is happening to me all the time is just a language. How do you interpret Trump's language? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time people listen to what Trump says, but they don't listen to what he means. And a lot of the time his audience is connecting with what he means, mm-hmm. which is why they don't care about what the media reports on what he says. And so what I'm always trying to do is exist in a space where I connect with the language that people are using, and I try and translate it into a language that I can then translate to somebody else.
Well, I hope that a lot of this country's young children read your book, because I think it just – there are so many lessons in it, and it's really interesting to hear about your upbringing. Trevor Noah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Normally, a $200 million investment in a state like Kentucky would be great news all around. But when it comes from a Russian aluminum company, it raises concerns for some in Congress. The investment in an aluminum mill in eastern Kentucky comes from a company called Rusal that was under federal sanctions until January. Sydney Bowles is a reporter with Ohio Valley Resource. She joins us from Whitesburg, Kentucky, with more on this. Sydney, why are some Democratic lawmakers saying the aluminum mill investment raises questions about national security?
Right. So Democrats are concerned about this investment in part because some of the aluminum product that this company is going to be using may be going to some defense purposes. So because of the historic involvement of this Russian oligarch with close ties to the Russian government, Democratic lawmakers are concerned that in some capacity, this may constitute a national security threat.
And the oligarch you're talking about is Oleg Deripaska, whose name actually turns up dozens of times in the Mueller report. Remind us who he is and what's his involvement in this project.
Yeah, so Oleg Deripaska has been the primary owner in Rusal, this aluminum company. He is a powerful oligarch. He's sort of considered to be Russian President Vladimir Putin's sort of right-hand man in a lot of ways. And the U.S. government has in the past investigated him for fraud, for money laundering, and even for ordering the murder of a political business opponent. So the concern here is that because of this oligarch's ties to Putin, his involvement in Rusal may compromise that company's investments in the U.S.
And why is this happening now, just months after the sanctions were lifted?
Yeah, the timing of the deal is really interesting, especially given Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell's involvement in all of this. So sanctions were applied back in April of 2018, and pretty quickly, a lot of higher-ups within Rusal's parent company, N Plus, started this pretty massive lobbying campaign to get those sanctions lifted. That involved hiring a PR firm with close ties to the Trump administration, and it involved working with the Treasury Department to have Oleg Deripaska step back from his leadership role, and they agree that Oleg Deripaska will step down. He'll only have about a 44% ownership stake in this company. And 4 months later, this company makes a $200 million investment in Mitch McConnell's home state.
Which would be a pretty big economic boost for that part of Kentucky.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this part of Kentucky is sort of, it's tucked right up in where Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia all come together. It's really a part of the country where an investment of this size makes a real difference. I know from my reporting, there are a lot of people in this part of the country who are really excited about the jobs that this aluminum mill could bring.
And by the way, the state of Kentucky is also heavily invested in this project.
Yeah, that's true. A couple years ago, the government of Kentucky invested $15 million from a seed investment fund into this deal. So in a way, all Kentucky taxpayers are involved in this plan some way. We're uniquely invested in the outcome of this plant with these sort of questionable ties to this Russian company.
So what is the next step for this project? Is it moving ahead, or is this talk of investigation going to hold it up?
As far as I know, construction should be going forward. The plan is to open around late 2021, early 2022. As far as I know, I don't think this is hindering things in any way.
That is Sydney Bowles, a reporter for the Ohio Valley Resource. Sydney, thank you.
Thanks so much.
President Trump's state visit to the United Kingdom continues today. He is urging outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May to stick around to complete a trade deal with the U.S. as the U.K. tries to exit the European Union. Protesters are in the streets demonstrating against the president. A Trump baby blimp is flying over them. As all that happens, one Labour Party politician, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, is here in the U.S. visiting Boston today and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, what do you think of President Trump's state visit to the UK so far?
Well, I can understand it has to happen. The UK and the United States have obviously a long-standing relationship. It's of critical importance. But I will share that I find myself somewhat dismayed by the values that your current president has brought to the office. So I find it a real concern.
Do you find some of the things that he's said insulting to the UK, just that have made the news? He's insulted the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, in a tweet. He's called Meghan Markle nasty.
Insulting is on one level. That is obviously, I think, robs the office of President of the United States of the full dignity that it should have. But beyond that, I think it's actually some very unsavory politics that's being released. We've got it being released in the UK through the overtones of Brexit as well. And we know it's happening in other places around the world as well. So beyond insulting, I actually think it's pretty dangerous.
Do you think that President Trump has damaged the special relationship in any way in the long term? Or do you think when another president comes in, you know, things will still be as they have been?
Well, it's taken a toll. But what I would point out, and one of the reasons I'm here, is that the relationship between the UK and United States is not just about national government to national government. We have a fantastic relationship with US mayors. I'm meeting Marty Walsh while I'm here. I'm going over to Chicago. We're meeting the mayor of Chicago. Last year I was in with Rahm Emanuel. I've got a very good relationship with the US Conference of Mayors. So actually, one of the levels on which we can begin talking about international relations is not just national government to national government, but city to city. And actually, I think that is the vital shift we need in national and international politics.
What is the importance of having a relationship between, let's say, Bristol in the UK and Chicago?
Well, a whole number of levels. One is that the challenges we face as a world right now cannot be solved by national governments working alone. Climate change, migration, inequality, you need an international effort to tackle those. National governments are showing themselves singularly unable to build those relationships, more focused on walls and boundaries rather than looking at our genuine interdependence. But also, look at the city level. We share populations. In Bristol, we have a big Somali population. You have one in Minneapolis, you know. Mm-hmm. I was in a taxi drive. A taxi drove me to my airport a few months ago, and the driver had family in Minneapolis. Cities live with dynamism. Cities exist because people move, cultures move, finance moves. So we're not in the business of trying to stop things move. We're trying in the business of saying, how can we best position ourselves to take advantage of those movements? That is a very different conversation to the one that national governments are driving at the moment.
Okay, well, let's talk about the one that your national government is talking about right now, which is Brexit. Your town of Bristol voted 61% to remain in the European Union. You've spoken at anti-Brexit rallies. There's going to be a new prime minister soon, and the new deadline for Brexit is October 31st. What do you want to see happen now in the UK?
Well, I voted Remain in the first instance, not because I'm an unqualified lover of the EU. I don't think any political institution is perfect, but Brexit is the wrong answer to the right problem. The right problem is that people have been left behind by globalization. We have growing inequality. There's people feeling incredibly distanced from political decision making. But the offer being put on the table by the people that have manufactured Brexit is not going to solve those problems. They have no track record in working for working people and poor people. And it makes me very fearful. So I've never changed my position that Brexit is not in the UK's best interest. And there's a very false argument. There's one over here as well in the United States about taking back sovereignty. No one is poorer is more sovereign. Right. And every option we have before us with the Brexit plans that are being brought to us leave us poorer.
Well, are you worried that if, let's say, Boris Johnson is the new prime minister, he's a hard Brexiteer, that the UK will simply crash out of the EU with no deal?
That's a difficult one because I don't see how it happens. I don't see how it gets through Parliament.
Would it have to get through Parliament?
Yeah. I don't see how it gets through. You'd need the votes to get through in some form, and it would be self-sabotage. But I think our national politicians have not helped with this. I mean, even Theresa May, using the language of the Brexiteers, which is, you're betraying democracy, you're betraying the country, should never have used that language. When you don't know, when you've got a 50-50 bet, you do not raise the stakes and put the whole, you know, legitimacy of your democratic institutions at play. What we are seeing right now is the outworking of a democratic process. People disagree with Brexit. They can work within the democratic institutions to oppose it. That's the way the system works. In the United States, you have checks and balances. We have checks and balances in the UK. That's democracy.
I want to ask you one more thing. You are described as the first elected black mayor in Europe. Is that true?
We believe it is true. We think it's been confirmed, which is actually quite remarkable,
wow.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm remarkable. I'm just saying it's remarkable that, the first directly elected mayor of African heritage in the whole of Europe.
How does that feel to you?
Well, first of all, when it was mentioned, we wanted to fact check it to see if it was true. Mm-hmm. And I checked with my chief of staff again yesterday because I know I was doing some interviews, and he says, "Yeah, we think that is firmly established now." But it shows how far there is to go. The issue of race and politics is full of contradictions, full of hope and false dawns as well. But I hope that what I've managed to achieve is something that can have echoes out in other European countries. And I would say, actually, with the rise of the right and this kind of mock nationalist voice in European politics at the moment and in the UK in general, that someone like myself and someone like Sadiq Khan can actually be a symbol of hope rather than this politics of despair that's being peddled at the moment.
How much racism do you see right now in the UK?
Well, there has been a rising over hate crimes, race hate crimes around Brexit. We know that's just a fact. I mean, racism operates on a number of levels. You have the overt acts of hatred, right? But then you have the racism where no one says the wrong things, everyone says the right things, and yet they don't employ black people or black people don't get promoted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's much more difficult to deal with. This is stuff that Martin Luther King pointed out. You know, overt opposition from people of ill will is sometimes easier to deal with than shallow understanding from people of goodwill. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I've begun to feel incredibly uncomfortable the way the conversation is flowing in the UK and over here, actually.
You think it's better or worse on one side of the Atlantic?
It's different. So I think the interesting contradiction is we have more social integration. Like, I'm a mixed race man. My mum is a white woman. My primary family were caring family were white. But at the same time, I've been chased down the street as a young man with people calling me names that, you know, I can't repeat on air. So, and then I go back to a white family. So that physical integration is more common in the UK. But what you have in the U.S. that we don't have in the U.K. is a prominent black intellectual political class. You have Condoleezza Rice, you have Barack Obama, right. Colin Powell.
Steve Benjamin.
Well, that's just me, right? And Sadiq Khan. And now we have a few black MPs.
We've spoken to David Lammy on this show before, who's black. Yeah.
And, so you have that, and if you go into our universities. You know, amongst the Russell Group, the top 22 universities, you could probably count the number of black professors on one hand. Whereas I was at Yale a few years ago, we had black professors, and I was really taken by the diversity of the faculty and the student body. So the way race lands either side of this Atlantic is equally as powerful, but it just manifests itself in subtly but importantly different ways.
Okay, so let me just bring it back around then. Do you think that Brexit threatens diversity in the UK?
Well, diversity will be with us, whether we like it or not. That is just a fact. What it threatens is our ability to live with diversity and take advantage of it. And you've got contradictory stories. I am a physical embodiment of diversity. My granddad's from South Wales. His mum was from Ireland. My other white nan was English. My dad came from Jamaica as a 12-year-old. I have no problem with that. And as I often point out, if I celebrate my Welshness, it doesn't make me less English. If I celebrate my Englishness, it does not make me less Jamaican. And when I find out as Irish as well, I thought, wow, this is incredible, right? I have this dynamic identity, and now I'm married to a white American woman. And so my kids have all these heritages and this American heritage that traces itself back to Sweden. There is no problem with that. What we need to do is find a way of having the tools in society and in politics to live as though that's real and take advantage of it. It's not a liability. It makes life rich. But Brexit and the overtones of Brexit and the overtones of what's going on in American politics right now threaten our ability to live with diversity and take full advantage of it.
That is Marvin Rees, who's a Labour Party politician in the UK. He's the mayor of Bristol. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Apple's annual rollout of new devices and software yesterday could have been awkward because it came as reports surfaced that Congress and two agencies would look into Apple and other tech giants for possible antitrust regulation. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
And start with what was, you know, coinciding yesterday, Apple having this big event, major shifts in government affecting the tech industry. The House Judiciary Committee says it's looking into tech companies, including Apple. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are considering antitrust actions. This is after, you know, people like Facebook's co-founder, Chris Hughes, saying these huge companies should be broken up. How did they respond to that?
This has been a slow rolling thing that's been going on for the last couple of years, getting louder and louder. And even though there was news over the last few days that both the DOJ and the FTC would be looking at Apple and the other big tech giants, doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take action. It does mean they're looking at them. Congress will also look at them. Apple has been prepping for this for a long time in a couple of different ways. One, saying, look how committed we are to privacy. Mm-hmm. If your concern is privacy, we're okay. We're specifically not Google and Facebook. They've been saying that for years. And they've also been saying now for the last 6 months to a year, saying, hey, when you're concerned about big tech, don't lump all of big tech together. We're not the same as Google. We're not the same as Facebook. We're different than Amazon. We're our own thing. And if you want to talk to us about what we're doing, that's fine. Yeah. There has been a specific complaint lodged by Spotify, the music service, against Apple in the EU about antitrust concerns. And that'll be a bigger issue for Apple.
Yeah. But Apple wants to point out that they are this digital privacy crusader and that Google and Facebook, for instance, that's how they make their money, tracking user activity and behavior. So put that aside, what was their biggest announcement yesterday, at least in your eyes?
Well, this is aimed at developers. It's aimed for sort of the most hardcore Apple users and programmers. There's a very expensive new Apple PC that most humans won't want to buy, but Apple diehards might. And there's a lot of small stuff if you're an Apple developer you want to pay attention to. If you're a regular person, the real news is that iTunes, which has been the default music and media player for Apple for almost for decades now, right, is going away when the new software updates sometime in the next couple months.
Okay.
It'll be replaced by a series of smaller apps.
Okay. How do you feel about that?
So this is something that has been, again, happening for a while. When iTunes came out, it was sort of revolutionary. It was an easy way to consume music on your computer. You could download individual songs. You could rip them from your CDs. But for the last several years now, we've been moving to a world where you're streaming all this music, so you don't need a big, clunky, heavy app for that. If you do own a lot of music on your hard drive, if you ripped it or bought it, you get to keep all that, Apple says. It'll just be moved to a new piece of software. So it shouldn't be that big a deal. It's sort of more of a symbolic passing of an era.
Okay. We mentioned Apple's claim to privacy. There's going to be a privacy provision, single sign-on, secure sign-on, so you don't have to use Google or Facebook to log into different apps. And those companies can't track you.
That's pretty interesting, I think. I think it might be one of the more interesting things that comes out of there. It's mm-hmm. if you've been on the web, you've seen these buttons when you go to a website that say sign on with Google, sign on with Facebook. It's meant to be, for a user, a fairly easy way to tell a website who you are. Those websites and Google and Facebook then use that information to target you with ads, or could do so. Apple's arguing that they're not going to do any of that, that your information will be blocked in many ways from the websites. So that's interesting. What's also interesting is Apple's telling developers, hey, if you have an app that you use with us and you use this Google or Facebook sign-on, we are going to require you to use this Apple sign-on. And a lot of folks are saying, look, if the argument is Apple has a market power / antitrust problems, compelling developers to use its sign-on is the kind of thing that is going to make a regulator perk up. So we will see how that plays out.
Yeah. Look, just yeah. I want to ask you about a new ad that from Apple that shows different people falling asleep in front of their phones while Julie Andrews sings Stay Awake from Mary Poppins. Let's just listen to a little.
Stay.
Well, it ends on an image of a kid falling asleep in front of a phone. And the whole point is, hey, you know, we have batteries that make these things last so long that you fall asleep. Yeah. We're trying to get children not to fall asleep to their phones.
Well, more power to Apple for showing how people actually use the products. Yeah, I think this is probably one they'd want to take back, because they are spending a ton of time saying, look, we're going to make it easier for you to not use your phone. We're going to build in all sorts of devices that will tell you to get more rest, that will automatically sort of dim your computer or your phone at night, because we want you to get sleep. It's very important. It's a little incongruous. I don't think they're going to have to deal with very much blowback, though.
Oopsie. Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Well, they may get some blowback from you, Jeremy.
I just think it is so gross.
Right,
like, we really are, not just kids, but everybody. You shouldn't be looking at your phone as you're falling asleep.
To your phone. Okay, we'll try to stop. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.